Ladies and gentlemen, our first case for argument this morning is Rahman against Chertoff. Mr. Collette.
May it please the Court, I am Matthew Collette from the U.S. Department of Justice on behalf of the appellants. Any individual who believes that he or she has been stopped at the border in violation of the Constitution as a result of the terrorist screening database can bring an individual action challenging any detention or can seek redress under the agency's procedures to get off of the watch list. However, this case is wholly inappropriate for treatment as a nationwide class action. Membership in the classes certified here presupposes that a person has either been misidentified, that is, not on the list, but mistaken for someone who is, or overclassified, that is, legitimately on the database, but less of a threat than the government believes that person to be. While the plaintiffs purport to challenge various policies and practices that lead to misidentification or overclassification, it's impossible to determine whether those practices violate the Constitution or to fashion and enforce meaningful relief without a fact-bound inquiry into the person's status on the database, the basis for the government's decision to place that person on the database if they're there, the level of threat a person actually presents. All of these things require factual development and second-guessing of a government's national security judgments. The key here is that the same policy and practice, to the extent they're discernible, about which the plaintiffs complain, is constitutional when applied to some or in some situations, and assertedly unconstitutional when applied in other situations. And that is why the plaintiffs should be have to assert this claim as an individual claim rather than a class action. Let me move to the notion of whether this is possible to fashion or enforce relief here. The relief requested here would essentially be a follow-the-law injunction. Stop overclassifying people. Stop misidentifying people. Exactly what the class-wide relief and how that could be enforced is difficult to discern. If the court entered an order saying stop making errors, it's difficult to figure out how someone would sue or to come to the court.
We'll just tell you that right now. We want the government to stop making errors.
I would like the government to stop making errors as well. It would make my job a lot easier, although I might be out of a job.
It would apply to any police operation, right? You could have an injunction or a class action against the city of Chicago Police Department. Don't make bad traffic stops, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's what distinguishes this case from your typical class action. Take a racial profiling case, for instance. The harm in a case like that is you are being pulled over on account of race, and the result is to stop pulling people over on account of race. The plaintiffs here are seeking essentially to represent a class that they characterize as innocent people. So essentially it would be akin to saying to the police, you have lousy detectives, and they arrest the wrong person. A lot. Therefore, you need to have better procedures so you don't arrest the wrong person. How do you enforce that? How do you come up with an injunction that just doesn't do anything more than say, don't arrest the wrong person? And that is why this case is not at all like the cases that plaintiffs cite, the Rockford case and the other cases. Those cases, you can adjudicate the constitutionality of the practice or policy simply by looking at the policy or practice itself. Here, you can't do that. You need to first decide whether a person's been misidentified or overclassified. Making that determination of whether a particular detention violates the Constitution requires...
How would we determine, or a court determine, who's overclassified?
The only way the court would be able to determine that would be to go into government's records, many of which are classified and highly sensitive law enforcement records, to determine what threat level the government thinks the person has and what threat level the person actually has. That would be not only incredibly intrusive, but it would be inappropriate for a class action. It's one thing for an individual to come in and say, in my circumstances, you've detained me unreasonably for too long, or you detained me without because I don't have the threat level you think I have, or because you just made a mistake. It's quite another to come in and say we're representing a class of only the innocent people, not everyone, and we're saying you have essentially gotten it wrong when it comes to deciding we're on the list or deciding that we're more of a threat than you think we are.
You're just here, though, on the class certification question, correct? You're not,
yes.
You're not re-arguing your motion to dismiss.
No. We're just here, of course, we couldn't appeal that. We're not seeking pendant appellate jurisdiction on that. However, I do think the merits, or that is the standard that governs the merits, is relevant here, because you need to decide, you need to look at how a court would decide whether the policy or practice is constitutional or not. In order to do that in any given detention, you need to look at the individual circumstances of the detention. Once again, this is not akin to a case where you would be able to look at the policy itself and say, you're detaining all people with Muslim surnames, or you're detaining people on the basis of their religion. The class there is readily discernible. The policy can be adjudicated just by looking at the policy. Here, that can't be done. The plaintiffs have asserted that we are trying to make them have a fail-safe class, which would be improper. We don't think that's right. Our point is simply that it is impossible to know which claims will fail and which claims will succeed. And I think if anyone is trying to get a fail-safe class here, it's the plaintiffs, by saying we're only representing the people who've been improperly stopped. They've taken reasonableness out of their class definition, but they only want to represent the misidentified. They only want to represent the overclassified, as opposed to saying you have a policy and we're representing everyone to whom that policy applies, and you could tell just by looking at the policy whether it is constitutional or not. If there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Grossman.
Good morning. May it please the court. There are two inaccuracies in the presentation that the government has made today. The first is that these policies are not discrete, suggesting that what we want to do is for a court to go through records and reclassify and engage in second judgments that are being made by the defendants. And the second is the notion that maintaining a database in a manner that constitutes deliberate indifference is not a constitutional wrong that's subject to review and addressable and cognizable in a class action lawsuit. I'd like to illustrate these points briefly for you. First of all, there are two discrete policies in operation here. One set of policies take place on the ground.
Mr. Grossman, I'm not so much worried about what the defendant's policies are as the precise definition of the class. Who is in the class that's been certified?
The people that are in the class are U.S. The primary traveler class are U.S. citizens who, upon reentry to the United States, are detained as a result of the defendant's contested policies and practices. And those policies...
That rather states my problem. Who is in the class?
Well, the class...
It seems to me one needs to have, at a minimum, a class definition in which you can determine who's in the class by reading the definition. A definition that refers to the defendant's contested policies won't tell us who is in the class.
Well, the district court quite easily understood from our briefing, Your Honor, that that reference was to the policies of misidentification and overclassification.
No, they don't have a policy of misidentification.
They do, Your Honor.
One could imagine, I think, a class definition that would say all people subject to the following six policies, and then name six policies here.
But well, we can do that, Your Honor.
But that's not what this definition says.
Well, I think that you have
and
to...
And a definition that says, subject to the policy of misidentification, when there is no policy of misidentifying people...
There is a policy of misidentification. It is a policy of omission.
Oh,
it's
well,
recognizable.
Look, counsel, then it's even worse. If we don't agree on what the policy is, the class definition has now deteriorated and is completely flimsy. It's just air.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with you on this point. If you maintain a database in a manner that is deliberately indifferent, you don't know who's in it. The OIG who audited this database said that it is...
We don't know who's in the database, counsel. We don't know who's in the class, do we?
Yes, you do. And I'll show you two ways, if you allow me, to how we know precisely who is in the database. Every time someone comes through and is misidentified, and that is 25,000 people, so far, per the OIG's data, is defined by the defendants as in the class. Every single person who is misidentified. Akif Rahman is misidentified, therefore he is in the class. They have a list of people who are misidentified. That is our class. It's not problematic at all. We know precisely who they are. The defendants know precisely who they are. And why
doesn't the class definition say all the people who are on a particular list, and it's list, you know, here insert name of list, that would be a concrete, knowable class. But that's not the way this class is defined.
Well, maybe that precision would be required in a B3 class. But with due respect, in a B2 class, the committee comments themselves recognize that you can have a class that's unascertainable, that you can have a class that's amorphous, because the purpose is prospective injunctive relief. The purpose is not to give them notice. It is not to allow them to opt out. It is not to get money to them. It is not to do anything except to structure a systemic remedy which in the future will ensure that they're not mistakenly identified again. And that's not difficult at all. It may be difficult for the FBI in the manner that it administers this database, but the OIG is quite clear. In the September 7th report, recommendation number 17 is to prospectively identify people who are repeatedly stopped and misidentified and stop doing it. Now, that is not a difficult thing to do for any of us. We all understand computers sufficiently to know that that software is programmable, identifiable, and that it can be put into place. So there is a remedy, contrary to the representations that the government made, and the people that are identified will be identified through the same kind of process that occurs in any B2 prospective injunctive case. The remedy is systemic. It says, do this. It does not require anybody to come in and be identified. It does not require a district court to look at a file. And in fact, the district court has entered an order, the magistrate has entered an order already telling us that we can't have individual records. That order was entered last week. Last night at 11 o'clock, the defendants in this case filed objections to parts of that order, which allowed us to simply know the status of our 10 plaintiffs, whether they are misidentified or whether they are overclassified or on the list for purposes of standing. But besides that, there is not going to be a review of individual records in this case. And I'd like to stress to you that this is an interlocutory appeal. And in class litigation, as in most litigations, we develop discovery, we refine our positions, the class is subject to modification by the district court.
So the basis of your lawsuit, as I understand it, is deliberate indifference by the government, and you want that corrected?
We do, Your Honor. And the way that we want that corrected is not for the district court to second guess individual decision-makings. And I want to stress that. No one has ever requested the district court to do that. And the district court has been quite definitive in its motion to dismiss decision and in the class decision. It has told us, and we agree with the proposition, we've taken no appeal from any of the discovery orders that the district court has entered today, that, in fact, what this is about are a set of customs and practices and policies that are identifiable and that automatically deprive people of their rights. Now, let me give you an example of overclassification. This is not second-guessing anybody. This is what the OIG said when they went in and looked at the records. The OIG went in and said that 1 out of 5 of the complaints, 20% of the complaints that were filed with the agency complaining about watchlist status were people who shouldn't have been on the database at all. Now, let's look at the underlying problems that the OIG has seen and that we've briefed you about. First of all, there is a process by which 32,000 people were given the wrong handling code. The people who were supposed to be the lowest threat level got the most severe handling code. That happened to 32,000 people. We have described in our complaint.
But they didn't do that deliberately, did they? Deliberately in the sense that we're going to reverse it intentionally?
No, but I believe that it is appropriate systemic relief to ensure that 32,000 people have the proper classification today per the FBI's own classification system. Similarly, they have a discrete problem that the OIG has recognized, that they have no low threat classification whatsoever. Everybody is treated warning, approach with caution. We have doctors who have lived here their whole lives who are U.S. citizens who have had guns drawn on them crossing the border. They've been removed from their cars at gunpoint in front of their children, put on the hood of their car, patted down, removed from their families, separated for 6 hours, interrogated, and it happens over and over and over again. When we filed our amended complaint in January of 2006...
Counsel, what is the benefit of handling this case as a class action rather than an individual suit?
Because they can't get it right. They can correct my guy the first time, maybe. But the problem is that you need a systemic remedy, or our front door never swings shut.
That sounds like a reason not to handle it. The flavor of the brief and the flavor of your argument is we want the district judge to take over and replace the secretary because we think the secretary can't get it right. And that style of remedy is a creature of the past. It's not something that's going to be approved today.
No, I take exception with
it. So assuming that remedy isn't going to be approved, what's the benefit of this as a class action?
Well, let me give you some remedies, Your Honor, because we don't propose for a second that type of remedy take place. We understand the construct for relief in the federal courts. For misidentified people, we think that they ought to be a remedy consistent with the September OIG report of 07, Recommendation 17, a proactive system to identify people who repeatedly are misidentified and corrected. Now, they can do that. We know that they can do that, but it must take place systemically. For people who are overclassified, we believe that the 1-4 switch ought to be mandated. That is, that everyone who was given the highest classification by mistake themselves, that must be reversed. We believe that they have to create a closed case procedure. The OIG recognizes that after the FBI closes a file, it forgets to tell the terrorist screening center to take the person off the list. We believe that they should create a low-threat classification. That is the OIG's recommendation.
I've got my ideas for managing this issue. I wish I were the Secretary of Homeland Security. I can do it better. But that was the siren song of these managerial decrees.
Now, this is prospective, Your Honor. This is regulatory
counsel. Trying to shout down a judge asking questions is just not productive.
I apologize, Your Honor.
But as I understand these managerial decrees, all of them were entirely prospective.
Your Honor, this is a case-by-case determination. I don't know what to address. Do you want me to address the abstract question of past cases with managerial decrees? I don't know how to do that. I can tell you what the harm is here, and that if it is in fact unconstitutional, there should be a remedy. And in the first instance, they can submit a plan to do that. But we haven't reached that place in this litigation right now.
If your clients are harmed by these policies, couldn't the relief that they get individually be a modification of those policies if all you're seeking is injunctive relief?
Well, we'd like to do that. But the way to ensure that occurs is to make it a class, Your Honor.
Why does that make it more probable?
Because it obviates any kind of problems there are with mootness and standing. Our clients...
I'm not following you there. Are you concerned that suddenly your clients will be removed from the lists and then mooted?
Yes, I would address you to sealed materials that we have filed. That has been our experience. There are materials that indicate behavior that may there are sealed materials that may inform your judgment about that matter. For the family class, we think that a court can order improved detention facilities. Why should someone have an unsanitary bathroom just because they are coming back from Toronto visiting their families and they don't have a place to change their child and they're held in a facility for 6 hours? We believe that families who are detained ought to have access to appropriate food. We believe that there ought to be a system for alerting relatives who are waiting for them in Chicago to return after 6 hours. Now, all of those things we suggest to you are not necessarily a matter of what we believe as opposed to what the Secretary believes ought to be appropriate conduct. At some minimum threshold, there is a standard of reasonability. And I don't think it's hard to agree how families ought to be treated under the Fourth Amendment. I don't think unreasonable is a difficult standard for us to deal with. And I submit to you, if some of our ideas that we propose to you today seem to be our idea versus the Secretary's idea, the litmus test is the Fourth Amendment standard of reasonableness. And under Rule 54D, the district court sitting in equity will make decisions about the appropriateness of specific remedies. But we are in an interlocutory appeal state. We're only in the beginning of the discovery process. We have spent 18 months dealing with the threshold questions of state secrets privilege and law enforcement.
Would you say this
privilege.
Is sort of a moving target, though? Is this static back when the OIG it made their report? Nothing has changed since then?
Well, the best indicator to us of that, first of all, the OIG has no power to make things happen. The OIG can only make recommendations. The best indication to us is in 206, when we filed our amended complaint, our 8 families had 37 detentions. We just filed an amended complaint in the district court, and the families are now up to 50 detentions. So whatever recommendations the OIG has made, it is our position that those have not been implemented, certainly not in a meaningful or effective way. And as a consequence, we have people pouring into our office day after day with the same facts. And I want to stress to you that the policies that are identified at pages 11 through 13 in our brief are the Homeland Security policies. And so they are rigid. They are defined. And I cannot reference them because they are under seal, but I can point to the facts of our individual clients. When you come across the borders, they pass your passport through the reader, the sirens go off. You are forcibly removed from your car by armed guards. You are searched, perhaps on the hood of your car in front of your children, and patted down and taken off. Your family is directed to go to a waiting room where they may be for up to 6 hours. A third of the 50 stops that we have and that we define in the amended complaint are over 3 hours in length.
But they chose not to file individual lawsuits based on that?
Well, these people have done all sorts of things. They've complained to the government. They've filed FOIAs. They were told all sorts of different things. They always pursued...
I ask if they filed individual lawsuits.
No, they are part of this class action, Your Honor. They all have standing and seek relief for themselves, on behalf of themselves and the class. And while your family is sitting in that waiting room for 3 to 6 hours, they are held incommunicado. They can't call a relative. They have no access to food.
But that gets back to my question. They didn't file... Haven't they filed?
They seek relief through this lawsuit, Your Honor. They have filed.
They're more concerned about the entire class rather than protecting their own children or individuals.
Well, I think they seek relief for themselves as well as their class. I don't think they've done anything that's remotely subject to condemnation from us.
Well, I didn't say that, but I'm just asking if they would pursue it in a normal way of false arrest, where you might bring a lawsuit against the government.
They don't seek compensatory damages. They've waived their right to money. They seek nothing but a remedy for themselves and their fellow U.S. citizens. This is a case brought on behalf of a class of citizens. These aren't people where the law is unclear. We don't do this to U.S. citizens returning from visiting their families in Canada. This offends our basic sense of reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment. If you have a warrant system that keeps spewing out bad warrants, that's subject to condemnation and injunction. That's happened in the district court here because Cook County Jail can't run their system. That was a Vorsik. There isn't any question that we ought to be able to address it, that we should be able to address it in a discrete
Thank
class
you, Mr.
way.
Grossman.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Collette?
I think this is a case with a moving target. If you look at the prayer for relief, pages 109 to 110 of the appendix, none of the specific requests that Mr. Grossman just talked about are there. Every new OIG report, we get a new claim with different so-called policies or practices. The complaint in this case talks about the result rather than the actual policies and practices, the policy of overclassification, the policy of misidentification, which is the result of these alleged failures. And that is not something that is susceptible to a class action. I also wanted to add that Mr. Grossman referred to a new complaint, which now includes 50 detentions. He did not mention that they've added quite a number of new plaintiffs here. So the number of detentions is more because they've added new named plaintiffs. The scenario that Mr. Grossman talked about, blaring sirens being pulled from your car, an individual circumstance, that there's no indication that that happens to everyone or how many people that happens to. That's why this case is inappropriate for a class action. Whether a certain detention is unconstitutional will depend upon the particular case. Somebody pulled aside handcuffed, held for 6 hours, is in a different position from someone that says, wait a minute, can you come over here? I need to look at this list, and detained for a short period of time. Therefore, we would urge that the class certification here be reversed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.